I'm Callie Crossley, sitting in for Michelle Martin. You are listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, a shakeup in the South African Health Ministry leads to questions about that nation's AIDS policies. That's later in the program. But first, some surprising research about how neighborhoods affect academic achievement. A new study suggests that poor children may not improve performance in school just by moving to a more prosperous community. The research followed families involved in a program called Moving to Opportunity from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. The children of these families, on average, showed no significant academic improvement after moving from poor to middle-class neighborhoods. Joining us to discuss the findings is Xavier D'Souza Briggs. He's an associate professor of sociology and urban planning at MIT. Also with us is Stephanie DeLuca. She's a sociologist at Johns Hopkins University who's written about the Moving to Opportunity program in Baltimore. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Thanks, Kelly.
Let's begin with you, Stephanie DeLuca. Can you explain the Moving to Opportunity program?
The Moving to Opportunity program was in part motivated by some research carried out in Chicago in the late 1980s, early 1990s, that showed that families who had moved from public housing projects into better neighborhoods in the outlying Chicago suburbs had significantly better outcomes in terms of children experiencing better schools. The results were found to be very compelling, and the architects of the Moving to Opportunity program decided to carry out a full-blown social experiment with a group that received the treatment and a group that received vouchers but didn't have to move to low-poverty neighborhoods.
What did you find from your research?
When interviewing families, I found that there were a number of families who did benefit in terms of their children being able to go to better schools. But I also found that parents approached schooling choice decisions in ways that were unexpected. Often the choice of where to send a child to school is not the most important thing on a family's agenda at any given time. Often there were other concerns that had to be juggled, like drug addiction, health issues, a constant shuffling of family members, and just trying to make ends meet.
Let me break out part of that. So as a middle-class family might look at an area and go for the school, the best school for their kids, poor families had other issues, you're saying to us.
That's absolutely right. The subway and easy access to buses was very important, and also being close to other family members who could take care of children while mom was working.
Now, notwithstanding finding that out, did the overarching bottom line of this surprise you?
I think it surprised a lot of us based on, theory from other research that would suggest that families moving from these very dangerous high-poverty neighborhoods to low-poverty neighborhoods, we expected to see a lot of good things happen, sort of assumed by osmosis that this would happen. So on the one hand, we were certainly surprised and disappointed because a number of other papers in the past had shown some kind of association between better neighborhoods and, better individual outcomes, including work that I've conducted in the past. On the other hand, the program was a housing-only intervention. There were no, attempts to give parents information about better schools.
Let me turn to you, Xavier D'Souza Briggs. These findings seem to contradict commonly held beliefs about bad neighborhoods holding back kids. And so we're curious, what could account for this?
I'll be honest, Callie, I don't find them very surprising at all. And the widely held beliefs are not very informed. They're sort of folklore about how neighborhoods work. You got to keep a couple things in mind. First of all, it's a myth that Moving to Opportunity got families to solidly middle-class neighborhoods. For the most part, that didn't happen, even at the outset.
What kind of neighborhoods did they go to?
Well, they moved from extremely poor, very high crime, very distressed public housing neighborhoods, the areas that were exploding with violence in the early 1990s because of the crack epidemic, among other things, to somewhat poor, much safer neighborhoods. And like hundreds of thousands of other families, especially low-income families, the families in this program in many cases moved to the outer parts of cities or the inner, older suburbs, places that in many cases now have very midland school districts. They're struggling with many city-like problems, gangs, school failure, school dropout. You add to that the choice factor that Stephanie talked about, the way the families thought about schooling, the fact that their own experiences and those of their friends and relatives, the people they turned to for advice about choosing a school, didn't make enrichment, the sort of top of the list. If anything, it was security, consistent with how they chose their housing. They tried to keep their kids away from schools known for having gangs and that kind of thing. I think most parents would say that's really smart, but that is not going to get you school achievement.
So based on the kind of concerns that Stephanie has outlined and that you've just underscored, can a move like this, in fact, make a poor family feel more isolated? And could that affect school achievement?
Well, we did interviews also with families and hung out with young people quite a bit in Boston, New York, and L.A., and there were some instances of that, but not too much. Most of these families continued to socialize with relatives and friends that they had left behind in the inner city. Their social worlds were still anchored there to a great degree. Others wanted to get away, frankly, from some of the people in their lives, including very needy relatives, people they were connected to that they thought were risky and needy, that they wanted to get their kids away from. So you really had different kinds of choices that families made. And it was certainly not the general case that families felt isolated in these new communities.
You're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Callie Crossley in for Michelle Martin. We're talking about how neighborhoods impact the school performance of poor kids. I am joined by Xavier D'Souza Briggs of MIT and Stephanie DeLuca of Johns Hopkins University. Stephanie, did these students encounter new troubles in their new schools?
Well, it seems that some of the young people who moved to better schooling environments, as measured perhaps by smaller classrooms and higher academic standards, did experience some trouble understanding the new standards. And one of the mothers in one of my interviews talks about how it took her a while, while she was frustrated, to understand that that there were higher standards to get the same grades in the city that he was, that he wanted to get in the suburbs. And then remember, a lot of these children remained in the same kind of school district that they were in when they first, signed up for the program. And so similar troubles continued to develop.
Given what we know, Xavier, about new troubles, what kind of support would a poor student who made a move to a middle-class school need?
Well, certainly you could put in place mentoring programs, additional counseling. By the way, the intervention could have, from the beginning, as Stephanie says, have been broader than housing only. One could have had some housing counseling, a bit on schools and the school choices and how to choose the best school for your child. This is a tricky problem, though, when a kid goes through a really big transition. We're saying two things here. On one hand, many of these kids did not make a very dramatic transition in terms of school, maybe not dramatic enough. On the other hand, Stephanie's talking about some kids that had trouble, and she, a few minutes ago, told you the history of this and how it was inspired by a court-ordered desegregation program in Chicago. In that instance, and that program was at a peak in the 1980s, the kids went through extremely dramatic transitions, many of them, going from inner-city Chicago public housing or neighborhoods nearby out to solidly middle-class neighborhoods that deserve that label, solidly middle-class school districts, in some cases 30 miles from inner-city Chicago. And those kids described to researchers how they faced profoundly different standards. And they had been on the honor roll in some cases in inner city Chicago, and now they found themselves achieving below grade level. But you know what? They were more likely to finish high school and go on to college at the end of the day.
Which leads me to ask, busing was one attempt to move minority kids into schools with better resources. Did that work? And are there better results when you only move the children to schools as opposed to moving the whole families to better neighborhoods?
I'll give you my take. I'd be curious to know what Stephanie thinks. I mean, the best available evidence is that careful efforts to bus kids from inner-city environments out to truly high-performing school districts, on average, have dramatically positive effects. But there isn't the political will to sustain those programs. The logistics of them can be a nightmare. Some kids are on the bus for hours and hours. There are voluntary programs in place in different parts of the country. But really, there's been a rolling back and a retrenchment against busing for many, many years, and it was not popular in some quarters to begin with. Over the long haul, housing solutions look like better solutions. For most families in America, there isn't a conscious choice of a school. There's a choice of a community, and the school comes in the package. But to get there, we'll need to change the way we run affordable housing programs, the way we develop communities, the way we think about what it means to have a competitive and inclusive suburb, and we're not there yet.
Stephanie, what do you think?
I agree with everything that Zav just said, and it's important, too, to recognize in terms of the court cases that have come down over the decades, that housing policy issues and education policy issues, concerns, and the effects of both housing and education on family and children have not been linked. The early cases, the Brown case in the 50s, for example, was focused primarily on education, didn't consider housing, and a lot of the legal scholars note that considering where people want to live is too tricky for the courts to handle. And so a lot of the most important cases in desegregation in the educational spheres did not consider housing. And I think that that kind of connection, that was an opportunity missed and in many ways paralyzed the ability for some of the desegregation legislation to have its full impact.
Xavier, if, as the new study suggests, moving kids who are at risk does not raise their test scores, moving them to a more prosperous neighborhood, what will work?
There's a long list of ways through better teacher collaboration, smaller class sizes, different interactions with kids, different expectations, after-school programs. But I think if we want to ask the question, how do you expand the geography of opportunity for people so they can live in communities that are safer, where the schools are better, where they have better job prospects, better health prospects, and so on, and there is an important connection between housing and schools, but we would need to use our housing tools to get families to the kinds of communities that have really strong schools and then help their kids succeed there.
Xavier D'Souza Briggs is a professor of sociology and urban planning at MIT. He joined us from MIT Video Production and Digital Technologies in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Stephanie DeLuca is a sociologist at Johns Hopkins University. She joined us here in our studios in Washington. Thank you both.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.